welcome to the final lecture, last but not least, in our series, this Creor series on religion and globalization. Before I introduce our speaker for this evening, I have a couple of business matters to attend to. I hope to be able to lure you into our series of lectures next year. And the title that we have chosen for our theme for the Creor lectures in the fall term of 2011 is Neurotheology in the 21st Century, Religion and the Brain. And this is a very appropriate subject, I think, for McGill University. I was at a meeting of Senate just a couple of days ago, and the principal announced that everybody pretty much in the university agreed, or at least many of people in the university agreed, that neuroscience was among the top priorities of this university. So we're tapping into that, and there's quite a lot, I think, that needs to be said about religion and the brain. And the second announcement I'm very happy to make is that we have video podcasts of our series of lectures I've actually seen them. They aren't yet published in the public domain, but they will be, I'm told, available within the next few days. So I would suggest that if you're interested in viewing a lecture that you may have missed, some people I know, because of the change in schedule, missed Professor Sharma's lecture a couple of weeks ago. These lectures will now be accessible to you on the website of the Center for Research on Religion. And we'll try to get as many places in that website as possible where you can actually gain access without too many clicks. So let me please turn to the main business of our gathering together here this evening. It's my very great pleasure to introduce to you tonight the lecturer. His name is Professor Akbar Ahmed. I have to say that we have among us a philosopher king. This was somewhat of our subject of conversation at the restaurant the other evening, and you will gather why I've come to this conclusion when I've told you about Professor Ahmed. He holds the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies, as well as the Professorship of International Relations at American University in Washington, D.C., where he gazes upon the good. He was born in Allahabad, a small town on the Ganges River in what was then British India. And since then, Dr. Ahmed has had a distinguished career as an anthropologist, a writer, and a filmmaker. He holds degrees from both the University of Cambridge and the University of London. He is actively involved in interfaith dialogue, and his work is to bring understanding between Islam and the West. And this has included no less than 3 appearances on Oprah and also a BBC news series called Living Islam, first broadcast in 1993. The study of global Islam and its impact on contemporary society has been the major focus of his work, both in the academy and in the public sphere. Dr. Ahmed first became interested in Muslim leadership and its impact on Muslim society in the 1980s when he was commissioner in Baluchistan, in Pakistan's largest province. As his distinguished career straddles both the senior civil service of that country and the academy, and it bears interestingly, I think, a notable similarity to the career of Professor Arvind Sharma, who lectured in this series a couple of weeks ago. From 1999 to 2000, Professor Ahmed served as the Pakistani High Commissioner to the Court of St. James. That's code for London. He's also held many other senior positions in the civil service of Pakistan. In September 2008, he was appointed the first Distinguished Chair of Middle East Islamic Studies at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. And from the fall of 2009 onwards, he was appointed Distinguished Visiting Affiliate at the U.S. Naval Academy and has been a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution for several years. Among Professor Ahmed's many award-winning books are Journey into Islam, The Crisis of Globalization, published in 2007, Discovering Islam, Making Sense of Muslim History, Society, Postmodernism and Islam, Predicament and Promise, and Islam Today, A Short Introduction to the Muslim World, as well as the Jinnah Quartet. Most recently, Professor Ahmed published a book titled Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam, which is the title of his lecture this evening. I would like to mention in conclusion that in addition to being a philosopher king, Professor Ahmed is a playwright. Plato said that the poets were liars, but I think in some sense he retracts all of that at the end of the Republic with the myth of Ur when he paints a great image. But Professor Ahmed seems to be engaged in that himself. The eponymous character of the play Dara Shikoh is a 17th century Mughal prince and a Muslim intellectual with Sufi leanings. He engaged in dialogue with people of other religions and rejected harsh, rigid interpretations of Islam. And this is the subject of a play that Professor Ahmed wrote a couple of years ago, which was performed in Washington, D.C. The play, I think, I haven't actually read the play, but I have looked at a summary of its plot that depicts the trial in northern India at which Shikoh, the prince, is sentenced to death after his younger brother, Aurangzeb, seeking the throne for himself, accuses Dara Shikoh of apostasy from Islam. So the play exposes the shallowness of the arguments against Shikoh, the Sufi, and highlights the role of his sister, Jahanara, in honoring his intellectual openness. This is a really interesting play. It would be nice if we could have this performed in Montreal at some point. Please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Professor Akbar Ahmed.
Thank you, Professor Kirby, for that very warm introduction and very rich introduction. You took us to all kinds of places outside Montreal. Indeed, we took us to the Mughals many centuries ago. I'm delighted you're all here on this cold evening. I'm delighted His Excellency Akbar Zeb, the High Commissioner from Pakistan, is here with us. The focus of my talk, as Professor Kirby has said, is Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam. And that allows us then to draw larger conclusions and draw bigger principles than just one particular region to study Islam's interaction with a Western society. My lecture will be in three parts. I'll speak for about 40 minutes, and then we will have a Q&A. So the first part will be to outline the problem, second part to describe the method, and third, what I think is the way forward. Now, this great series that Professor Kirby is running, and I do congratulate him for it, has at its heart the idea of us living as human societies in the 21st century, the notion of human rights, the notion of understanding each other, the notion of acceptance and tolerance. And as we are in a chapel, I will share with you some very moving insights from Islam, unexpected, about Jesus. And some of this will really be very surprising to some of you. I know the scholars may have picked this up. So here's Rumi, 13th century poet, the most popular poet in the United States of America, writing about Jesus in his famous Jesus poems. He has an entire collection of very intense poems about Jesus. Where Jesus lives, the great-hearted gather. We are a door that's never locked. If you are suffering any kind of pain, stay near this door. Open it. Hafiz, in the next century, the most beloved poet of Persia, writes, in the Christ's breath, I am a hole in a flute through which blows the breath of Christ. Listen to this music. And Akbar, the great Mughal emperor, Professor Kirby mentioned it, his great-grandson, in the 16th century, at the entrance to his new capital, the great new capital he builds, Fatehpur Sikri, right at the entrance, he quotes not the prophet of Islam, but Jesus. And he says, Jesus, on whom be peace, has said, "This world is a bridge, pass over it, but build not your dwelling over there." His successors, like Jahangir, Emperor Jahangir, had so many miniatures with Jesus, with Mary, and himself looking at these paintings with adoration. Now, the point I'm making here is to illustrate a particular aspect of Islam that at its core allows for, indeed encourages, interaction with other systems, which somehow has been lost and broken in the Muslim world today. For me, the problem, quote-unquote, begins on 9/11 itself. I had just joined American University in Washington, D.C., as the chair of Islamic studies. In August, in a couple of days, I would be giving my first lecture, my first talk, and I was in class when the plane flew into the Pentagon. Now, as Professor Kirby said, I have been in the field. I know the Muslim world, the Muslim cultures, Muslim societies, and I knew that there would be a problem. There would be a problem on both sides. I knew that there would be a huge gap opening up, and it would take a lot to close this gap. Perhaps it would not close very soon or easily. And I knew that as a Muslim scholar sitting in Washington, the nation's capital, I had to do everything possible, use every experience of mine in the past, every contact I had, to try to promote the building of bridges over this gap in whatever way I could, however tiny. And it was almost a mission that I embarked on, and it's almost been a decade, and I've been true to the mission. So we, and me, when I say we, it's not the royal we, I'm talking about myself and my team of young American researchers and assistants. We wrote books and plays and articles, and I visited the Pentagon, the White House, the State Department, and most important, launched the first Abraham Summit in Washington, D.C. This is with the Bishop of Washington and the senior rabbi. And it was very effective because it generated a lot of genuine interfaith movement where none had existed in Washington, and where increasingly it became important for America just to see a bishop, a senior rabbi, and a Muslim scholar talking with great cordiality and amiability. But alas, that gap remains as wide as ever. So all my efforts, the efforts of the bishop and the rabbi on one level, very successful, on another level, have not succeeded. The gap remains very wide. Here are some examples of the controversies now permeating American society. There's a widespread belief in America today that the Sharia, Islamic jurisprudence, has been either imposed on America or is about to be imposed. Now, this is so widespread that very often when I'm giving talks, people will ask me, Professor, why are you Muslims imposing the Sharia on us? And it's a very difficult question to answer because it's rooted in anxiety, in uncertainty, and a kind of blind belief that it is happening. And a lot of so-called experts on Islam are saying this. They're saying this in the media. They're constantly saying the Sharia is about to be imposed. You will have your hands chopped off, your legs chopped off, women will be stoned, and all those horror stories we hear from the Muslim world. The Sharia is coming. And I try to explain very calmly and very coolly that America, the United States of America, has a Muslim population of about 2%. Now, 2% in a functioning democracy, which is the United States of America, 2% of the population cannot impose its will on 98% of the population. It's mathematically absurd. In any case, if the Muslims were so keen on the Sharia, then they would have imposed it first in their own societies. Pakistan has a population of 98% Muslim, and maybe a couple of percent Christians and some Hindus, and there is no Sharia. The constitution is not run by Islamic jurisprudence. Afghanistan is the same, Bangladesh the same, Indonesia the same. So it's highly illogical that those Muslims who are escaping those collapsing systems in their home come to the United States of America and demand the Sharia. It doesn't make any sense, but people genuinely believe the Sharia is upon us. In Oklahoma, I'm sure you've read, the good folk have actually passed a law saying stoning will not be allowed and cutting of hands will not be allowed, etc. Because again, the assumption is the Sharia is here. And while there's some really terrible aspects to the Sharia in some parts of the Muslim world when it is imposed, I can point out that even in a country like Pakistan, where there's so much turmoil and chaos and violence today, that even there, actual punishments, for example, the blasphemy law, have never been implemented. So it's more bark than bite. The Ground Zero Mosque controversy, you'd have heard of that here in Canada. Now this completely transfixed America a couple of months ago. People were debating this, discussing this, lines were being drawn, the Democrats took one position, the Republicans took one position, and the entire country seemed to have been locked into this debate. Now, as you know, the Ground Zero Mosque is neither at Ground Zero, nor is it a mosque. But in the public, this again became a great symbol of the Islamic threat. And people were actually saying that this is a vindication, this is a symbol, this is a manifestation of Islamic triumphalism. So Muslims are building this huge structure to say, here we are on Ground Zero, as a mark of triumph. In fact, Imam Rauf, who was behind this mosque, who is to be faulted, certainly from my point of view, on not thinking this whole thing through, he should have thought much more carefully about the idea of building anything so overtly Islamic, so near Ground Zero. He really should have thought about it. He did not. He's not a man who would want to provoke anyone, because he is totally committed to interfaith understanding and dialogue and bringing peoples together, which is what he's been doing for the last decades. So he'd be the last man to be triumphalist. And yet, that's what the media would have us believe. The media, in fact, was depicting him as in some kind of a hardline extremist, terrorist, with all kinds of designs. The Quran burning, or the threat to burn the Quran by Pastor Terry Jones, you may have heard of that. That was an incident which thankfully did not happen, but it was building up a lot of tension. Again, there were people on both sides. I wrote an article in CNN.com around that time. I got my bishop friend and the senior rabbi and some other very prominent Americans to agree to the content of the article and published it, and it got thousands of hits, so a lot of people read it. But what was fascinating was the commentary at the end of it. That really will give you an insight, it's still up there, into how Americans were thinking about this issue. So there were so many comments which said things like, don't only burn the book, burn some Muslims with it. And I'm hoping that was the old American sense of humor and they weren't being literal about it. Some even said, we'll bring marshmallows. And this kind of remark, as you read the comments into what people were thinking, but the idea of confrontation, of taking on Islam, was very, very up there in front. Muslims were being depicted widely as cruel, as violent, as unreliable, as believers of something called the moon god. They were a cult, they were not a religion. They were idol worshippers, stone worshippers. And it was very difficult to try to convince Americans that there is a great deal of overlap between the three Abrahamic faiths. And I have just cited you the reverence and love that Jesus is held in Islam. And of course, I can go on and give examples of Moses and the other great figures, and of course, Abraham, the eponymous ancestor, in a sense, of the Abrahamic faiths. For Muslims, Abraham is the absolute patriarch and prophet. They claim descent through Ismail, his son, the other son being Isaac, who is the ancestor of the Jewish peoples. So once again, in the public eye, Islam was not being seen in this context. It wasn't scholars and commentators who knew about Islam, who were commenting, but in fact people who just had an idea, prejudice, and opinion about Islam that were contributing. And to me, this was such a huge challenge, because to have Islam being depicted in this very cruel way was supported by so much of the news coming from the Muslim world. So what was happening in Pakistan was not imagined, or Afghanistan, or Iraq. There was widespread cruelty and chaos. And that, again, was a challenge to any Muslim looking at the Muslim world, because I, as a scholar of Islam, also know that Islam has had periods of great prosperity and great success in creating civilization in the most profound sense. And yet, what you are seeing in the Muslim world was mosques being attacked, churches being attacked, women being attacked, women's schools being closed. And you had to ask yourself, what was going on? What was going wrong? What were the leaders of the Muslim world doing about it? Could they halt this rot, this slide into anarchy? And the excuse, of course, if you talk to Muslim leaders, will always be the West. They'll say it's the West interfering, and the West is using the drone strikes, or some excuse to blame it on the West, not at themselves. Muslim leaders were not looking at themselves critically and saying, we need to be doing this. We need to be reforming our school system, or our health system, or our corruption in the system, or give justice to the people. They were not saying this. They were simply saying, in Pakistan, very often, if something happens, we'll blame the Indians. The Indians will blame us, as Professor Sharma will agree that there's an element of tit for tat. If something terrible happens in India, sometimes if a cricket match is lost, the Indians will blame the ISI, the intelligence services, and we'll blame the Indian raw agencies if we lose a cricket match. It's that bad. And yet we were not stepping back and saying, this is what Islam is. Islam, by definition, Islam is defined through an understanding of God in Islam. And God in Islam has two names, Rahman and Rahim, which a Muslim is asked to repeat daily for every occasion. So stepping out into the road, driving a car, talking to someone, about to eat, a Muslim is expected to say, in the name of God, the beneficent, the merciful. Now, if God is defined and defines himself in the Quran as compassionate and merciful, it is difficult to build an argument that Islam is violent for a Muslim. So when a Muslim goes off and blows himself or kills 30 or 50 people, random people, in some bus stop or on some plane or in some on a university campus, you have to ask yourself, is this Muslim being motivated by an understanding of a compassionate, merciful God, or what other motivation drives him? It is basically, to me, a sheer example of anger, of revenge, of the desire for retribution and frustration. It's complete frustration. There is no other way out. It's a complete failure in that individual. So the notion of a divine being that is compassionate and merciful is again being lost in our understanding here in the United States of America. And I'm talking on the popular level. So the questions I wanted to ask myself on this study had theoretical ramifications. First of all, of course, I wanted to ask, what does and how does a minority like Muslims, who are very distinct in terms of their names, their culture, they're not white, they're not Protestant, they are not from Europe, how does this minority adjust to a majority in times of crisis, post 9/11? So it's a minority adjusting to a majority. And we are not talking of minorities like the Italians and the Jews who came in the 18th and 19th centuries and had to go through a very tough process of assimilation. I wanted to ask about the intense cultural and political conflict among Muslim immigrants between their countries of origin and the United States. So Faisal Shahzad, for example, the New York bomber, who thankfully was caught before he did damage, he's from Pakistan. So he's torn in between his pull towards Pakistan and his pull to the United States of America. He's torn between these two. So again, I wanted to ask, what is going on? What are the cultural, what are the political, what are the social compulsions that drive someone like him, who we now know in the media as the homegrown terrorist? So the phenomenon of the homegrown terrorist. I wanted to find out, how did Americans see Muslims? There are many studies about Egypt and Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Middle East, and so on. But how did Americans see Muslims living in the United States of America? There are very few studies, surprisingly. Very, very few, in fact, to looking at them as a whole. And, of course, interfaith. Is it successful? Is it worth doing? When you talk to the like-minded, you're in a beautiful chapel like this, there's an air of spirituality, there's an air of goodwill, and we all are basically aware of what is common between us, and there's enough goodwill to generate a friendship or the possibility of a friendship. But out there, is it strong enough to then go into societies, into different communities? And if not, then what is the best way to tackle it? So again, the interfaith aspect. These were some of the questions I wanted to raise in this study. And as an anthropologist, an orthodox anthropologist trained in Britain, formal anthropology, I wish to conduct fieldwork, proper fieldwork, which involves participant observation, which means you go into the field, you stay with the people you want to examine, live as much as possible with them, eat with them, fast with them, pray with them, and interview them and talk to them and keep your diaries. And I was making it more complicated. I wanted to take a group of young American researchers, my team, with me. Some of them had been my students. I wanted them with me because I could trust them. I could trust them and their integrity and their hard work and commitment. And, of course, I didn't really have much of a budget, and they were keen to do this almost free, so they came along. So the first journey was to the Muslim world. And we went to the Middle East, to South Asia, to Far East Asia. Myself and my team. We met sheikhs, we met imams, we met professors, students, President Musharraf, prime ministers of Pakistan, princes in the Middle East, Benazir Bhutto. We met the whole range of society on this journey. And one of the questions we asked was, what is the number one problem you see with America? And when I say America, you'll forgive me, I'm meaning the United States of America. Because Canada, of course, has its own aspect and own way of dealing with the Muslim world, and which is quite distinct. And the number one problem for the Muslim world, and this was consistent, Middle East, South Asia, Far East Asia, was how Muslims thought Americans were distorting or misunderstanding Islam itself. So it was an understanding of Islam. We were all surprised. We thought it's going to be Israel or the Iraq war. They were there on the list, but the number one was this idea of Islam that they felt was being distorted here in America. The Muslim world, of course, is so complex. To use the words Muslim world is not to do it justice. But I decided to categorize it into three broad, not watertight, but overlapping categories. So if you took the mystics, we have examples from Rumi and Hafiz that I've quoted to you, the mystics. These are universal humanists. They reach out to all the faiths. They believe that our desire to get to the divine is shared by all of humanity, whether you're a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Jew or a Christian. And these are different paths to the same object, that is the divine. And you do that. You reach the conclusion, the end of the journey, by developing in yourself the capacity to love the divine and through that love humanity around you. The second category was the modernists. The modernists for us in, for example, South Asia would be the modernists who are produced by universities like Aligarh, which is a very famous university created in British India in the 19th century and now in India. Now, Aligarh produced a type of Muslim and eventually type of Muslim leader. People went on to become presidents, prime ministers on both sides of the border. They were both Muslim and Hindu presidents and prime ministers, foreign ministers from India. Modernists believed in balancing Islam and modernity. So you could be a good Muslim with integrity, with pride, etc. in your culture, and yet be modern. You could be a Canadian or a citizen of the United States and be loyal to both, be faithful to both. Modernist essentially means someone who can respect the Constitution, women's rights, human rights. And there are many examples of this, many, many examples of the modernist. The third category was the literalist. Now, the literalist would want ideally to live and behave as if the Muslim is in 7th century Arabia, to be as close as possible to the source of Islam, the origins of Islam. Now, these categories are neither brilliantly original, nor are they peculiar to Islam. Almost every religion has a similar kind of division of categories. The literalists believe that Islam is under attack and that it will be defended at all costs. The challenge is this, that a generation ago, when I was growing up in Pakistan in the 60s, it seemed that the modernists won the ascendant, that the modernists would be the future in the Muslim world. If you look around the Muslim world in the 60s, all Muslim nations are wanting airlines and they're wanting dams and they're wanting railways and they're wanting highways. They want to be part of the world order. If you look at the Muslim world today, you're seeing a Muslim world in conflict and chaos and a very large presence of the literalists who are almost defining Islam, whether it's the Taliban, whether it's Hezbollah, whether it's Hamas. And they have the capacity to inflict violence. And you can see this attack and counterattack and conflict in the Muslim world. The mystics are largely marginalized today. They're largely invisible. They are there. They're there in their millions, but they are marginalized and invisible. The modernists who defined the discourse a generation ago are on the run. And in some senses, their collapse, their corruption, their incompetence, their failure to bring Muslim societies into modernity has cost the Muslim world and is responsible for this chaos that you see. It is the collapse of the modernist that creates the vacuum into which rush the literalists. Nature abhors a vacuum. There's a vacuum, and the only force that can fill it locally in terms of society will be the literalists. That is what is happening. And that will be the struggle in the coming time. And of course, it involves the West, including Canada, very directly. We know you have troops in Afghanistan and troops in Kandahar, which is, of course, the home of the Taliban. So we studied the Muslim world, but we felt this study was not complete unless we looked at the other side of the coin. So if you see the study as a whole, half the study is based in the Muslim world. We now needed to look at what's happening in the United States and to ask how Americans were thinking of Muslims and how Muslims faring in America. Now, for this, I had luckily a sabbatical year coming up, a full year. And I took this full year and traveled with my same team, my trusty team again, to 75 cities and visited 100 mosques. We had thousands of questionnaires, extended questionnaires. We conducted hundreds of interviews, took lots of film footage. And at the end of it, we have the book mentioned by Professor Kirby, Journey into America, The Crisis of Islam, and a film alongside the book. The film took a life of its own. I had one of my students filming this whole journey, and like all students, with a lot of enthusiasm, we had these great American figures, Jesse Jackson, also these big senators and congressmen being filmed with their legs cut off or their hands cut off. And that's not the Sharia, it's this bad photography of the director as he was going along filming. So he had a lot of enthusiasm, but the technical skills were somewhat limited. The result was, at the end of the journey, we had this incredible footage. And it really is incredible. Footage which included interviews of the high and the mighty and ordinary students and taxi drivers and the grand wizard of the KKK, a stripper in Las Vegas. We had the entire range of society, the entire mosaic of American society. And it's fascinating. America is an incredible society. It really is a very dynamic, changing, bursting with vitality kind of society, and that's what we filmed. And that was then made into a film, a feature film, which we, with our confidence, a professor with the students, submitted to film festivals, and suddenly it was picked up, and a few months ago it was shown in France at a film festival, and I sent one of my young American assistants, who just out of school, graduate student, to the film festival, and he describes how he sat on the table rubbing shoulders with Clint Eastwood's latest film's director and crew and so on, and was talking about this particular film. So we are pleased that the film is also out there. Findings from the field in this travel. That the Muslims that we know as scholars on campus, on this campus, this great campus, McGill, that the Muslims are not a monolith. In the United States, they are far from a monolith. It's a tiny community, 2 million, 7 million, 2%, but they are far from a monolith. Every kind of Muslim is represented in America, every kind. They're Cambodian Muslims, Afghan Muslims, Egyptian Muslims, Libyan, the whole world is there. But broadly, you could divide them into three streams. The African Americans, the immigrants, and the white converts. And each is different from the other, overlapping but distinct. And so you may have a mosque dominated by the African Americans, another mosque in the same town dominated by the immigrants, and yet another by white converts. Their stories are also fascinating. Then there are smaller communities, not of African-American Muslims, but of African Muslims. And there's a nuance here. These are Nigerians or Muslims from Somalia. So they're not quite African-American yet. They are African. And there's some tension between the two. Muslims from Bosnia, European, who look like any mainstream white Canadian, blue eyes, blonde hair, and so on. And they would say this, these Bosnians would say, we have no problem at all in America. People see us and we have no problem, until people ask our names. And then they say, my name is Muhammad or Ahmed. And then suddenly, of course, people become aware that they are Muslim and therefore they're different. The African Americans were fascinating. African-American Muslims. I found them a completely fascinating. I was thrilled meeting them. The imams in particular. The imams are the people who lead the prayer and lead the mosque. Very inspiring. Inspiring because these African-Americans were responding to their society and looking for spiritual answers. They went to Judaism, they went to Christianity, they went to Buddhism, Hinduism, they looked around. And some of them found the answers in Islam. And remember, they are doing it entirely voluntarily. It's them as individuals looking for answers. Let me give you one example. And there are many, many in the book. We interviewed dozens. They are the best representatives of Islam and of America. Because they are American. These are African Americans. But they're the best representatives of Islam. They have absorbed and they have projected the finest version of Islam, compassionate, believing in interfaith, in respect. When I would meet them and accompany them, I'd go into the neighborhood, people would walk up to them, they'd embrace the imam would embrace these individuals, and he'd then tell me, he said, this woman has drug problems. I would say, is she a Muslim? No, she's a Christian. A Latino would come up, or a white person would come up who's homeless, he wants food. A Muslim would come up, he wants some job. The imam would deal with them all exactly alike. It's very African-American Muslim. So he's not saying my community, he's opening up to everyone in the best possible tradition of Islam. Imam Mustafa in Las Vegas. Just listen to his story. It is so inspiring. So here's this African-American. He's an intellectual. He's spiritually unhappy with life. He's in Las Vegas. He has no job. He's working in a casino. And he tells himself, he's a thoughtful man. He tells himself, is this life? Is this what it is? I'm surrounded by prostitution, drugs, alcohol, gambling. There has to be more in life than this. So he begins to search for some kind of spiritual meaning. He talks to a rabbi, he talks to a priest, and he's not satisfied till someone gives him the Quran and he begins to read it. And he says his life changes. So he's thirsting to get into the holy book. And he can't because he's working in a casino. So he shifts himself into the post where the baggage boy, the boy who takes the luggage in the elevator up to the room, so that while he's in the elevator, he's got the luggage with him, he presses the button, floor 20 or 24, whatever, and he has a couple of minutes to pull out the Quran and read a particular verse. And then on his way down, he presses the button and pulls out the second verse. And that is how he teaches himself to read the Quran and become a master of the Quran. And today he's a very respected imam in Las Vegas. So some very moving stories of people who are not coming through grand families or grand lineages or grand wealth, but have struggled for spiritual elevation and found it in a personal quest. The African Americans also talk of reverting to Islam. This is a phrase they use. When I ask them, when did you convert and why did you convert? They will say, we did not convert. We reverted. By this they mean that something like 40%, African Americans will say it's up to 60%, of the slaves who were brought on those terrible death ships across the Atlantic, where millions died as they crossed the Atlantic, were in fact Muslims. A lot of them were scholars, chiefs, noblemen, husbands, fathers, and they were captured, put in those ships, and that's it. Their life was completely transformed. But the percentage, the high percentage, 30, 40, 50% being Muslim meant that to them, to these people, there was something in the back of their minds, some atavistic yearning to go back. And that's what they say. They say, we are just simply reverting to a faith that we already had. This is the African American reverting to Islam. And of course, the interpretation then of American history, conventional American history, is directly challenged by their understanding of the American narrative. For American history, white America, history really begins with the landing at Plymouth, the Mayflower, the arrival of the Mayflower from England. And that's when the story begins. You know, suddenly we have American history coming alive. And of course, we are aware of the Native Americans and even Jamestown and so on, but American mythology rests on Plymouth. And Malcolm X, of course, refuted that myth by saying, we did not land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us by saying, in fact, that we are not here in a voluntary capacity, that we were brought here by force. And on this journey, as an anthropologist, one of the most fascinating excursions was to trace a direct descendant, an African-American woman, of Bilali Muhammad, who was a slave brought from Africa in 1800 or 1801. Mrs. Bailey was the 10th generation directly descended from Bilali Muhammad, 10th generations down. And I'd heard about her, and she lives on an island off the coast of Georgia in the Atlantic. So we went to that island, very difficult physical journey. Again, it took us a full day to get there, and then we had to climb onto this very shaky little boat. I'm dignifying it with the word boat, but it really was a little bark. And the Atlantic is a very choppy ocean, as you know. But we managed to get there. We spent the night there, and she opened up as the night progressed, and we had some incredible information from her. She, of course, said, I'm a Christian. But she said she recalls her grandmother saying that we were Christian by day and Muslim by night. Now this means that, go back to Bilali Muhammad, she's 10 generations down. Up to her grandmother, there's a consciousness of being Muslim. So as an anthropologist, I wanted to know what customs, what evidence do we have of Islam, or has it all been obliterated? And we actually counted 22 customs which could be directly traced to Islam. Many of them, for example, when these Christians walked into a church, men and women would separate. They would take their shoes off. Customs like this. They would wash themselves just like Muslims do in the same fashion, up to the elbows, the face, the feet, and so on, as part of the church service. The other category, the immigrants, again gave us some very interesting findings. The immigrants are divided broadly into those from the Middle East, the Arab world, and from South Asia. And here again, there's so many differences. So someone in the Arab world, and we can say the Arab world as if though they're a monolith, but they're so different. A Moroccan is completely different from an Iraqi. They're across the spectrum in terms of history, culture, and so on. They may share the Arabic language, and they may share the religion, but they have different cultural context. It's a different cultural context, historical context, and so on, to look at them. Similarly with South Asians, Indian Muslims have progressed in one way, Pakistanis in another way, Bangladeshis in yet another way, and yet there's so much that is common between them. But what surprised me certainly was that immigrants constantly saying, this is the best place in the world to be a Muslim. And that surprised me because I said, why are they saying this? How could they be saying? They're talking to me, so it's Muslim to Muslim. They'd be very outspoken if they didn't believe in this. And it really was because of the conditions at home, the conditions they're escaping from. So many of them are coming from Saddam's Iraq or the Afghanistan of the Taliban. They're escaping that chaos to come to America. And before 9/11, the condition of the Muslims in the United States was really very good because they were invisible. They just came in straight in as physicians, as entrepreneurs, as professors, as lawyers, without any problems. After 9/11, the questions emerged, and there was a lot of question marks on the community. Some of them quoted Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, saying that he's our icon, he's our hero, which, of course, is again something remarkable. So many of them were living, you could see, the American dream. And immigrants, Muslims, tend to be very hospitable. And that's, again, something we saw and enjoyed on this journey throughout. They would insist on hospitality in terms of putting us up or feeding us or looking after the team and being really warm and very welcoming to us, which, incidentally, we found throughout. I mean, everyone was very welcoming and open-hearted about receiving us. But the immigrants maintained this culture of hospitality. We also found Muslim leadership very divided. So the Muslim leadership of this small community remains divided. It is divided. It is not certain about the way ahead. It does not invest in the media. So you're not going to see many Muslims on television or writing op-eds. You will not see too many Muslims, blissfully more now, but not too many in interfaith dialogue. Before 9/11, there was virtually nothing. You will not see many on campus. So the immigrants coming to America came with a specific idea in mind, and that was to make money and send some of it home and have huge houses and live the American dream. So it was an American dream, but an empty dream, as we saw, because on 9/11, it sort of imploded on them. They are waking up now. It's a sort of reaction to the situation around them. It's a bit late, and they need to be much more active, much more focused, much more cohesive than they are now. They do face huge challenges, and I'm talking about Muslim leadership. We also saw on this journey and met and encountered some real horror stories. And there's a whole chapter on this in my book, and these horror stories are worth looking into because it's something that is not truly, quote-unquote, American in the context of the United States of America, which is a country which has always prided itself correctly on the fact that human rights and civil liberties and an idea of a new society is rooted in the U.S. Constitution, which is a remarkable document. And it reflects the vision of society of the Founding Fathers. And the Founding Fathers are a remarkable group of Founding Fathers. Washington, Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, Adams. These are extraordinary figures. And yet, here are the horror stories. For example, this boy, 10 years old, in a mosque. I was in this mosque in New York, in something called Little Pakistan. There's a place in Brooklyn called Little Pakistan, which after 9/11 was simply decimated of Pakistanis. So something like 50% of the Pakistanis disappeared. Some were deported, some ran away, some got frightened. They may have been on dodgy visas and so on, but 50%, just 50, 60% disappeared. So the trauma of 9/11 and that experience is still very much there in the community. When we went to spend the evening in this little mosque in New York, you could feel it in the audience. And after the prayers, the imam introduced me and then I could talk to them. We recorded their interviews. They were all sharing these horror stories. One story sticks out, and it moved the people with me, my team, to tears. This is a 10-year-old boy, American kid. He's born around 9/11, maybe 1 year older, before 9/11. He goes to school. He's beaten up every day. So his fellow students thrash him, and they call him a terrorist. His family goes to Pakistan, his mother and father, on some pilgrimage. And in Balochistan, the province where I served, the bus is blown up and his mother dies. So his mother has been killed by the Taliban and he's being beaten up for being a terrorist. Now this is a 10-year-old kid. He's going to be a teenager in a couple of years. And he's going to be a very troubled teenager and an angry teenager. And again, these are things in society that all of us have to be very conscious of. And this is not one story. We encountered story after story after story of this boy, people like this 10-year-old boy, 9-year-old boy, 8-year-old boys. So again, we are looking at the next generation. So while there were many challenges in the field, there were also many inspiring stories, feel-good stories, genuinely good stories. Let me give you two examples. Our friend, when I say I include Ambassador Akbar Zeb, Barry Hoffman in Boston. Now, Barry Hoffman is very Jewish. If you saw him walking in, you think he's just stepped out of the Old Testament. He has a flowing beard and he radiates spirituality. And yet he's the Pakistan Honorary Consul General. So think of this. The man representing Pakistanis, and he is so popular with Pakistanis that he has been the Pakistan Honorary Consul General for, I think, 30 years. What was it, Akbar Zeb? Since the 1980s or something? And a very popular man. So one of the most moving interviews was given by him when he's describing the plight of these Pakistani students who are suddenly not given visas after 9/11 through no fault of their own. And he described a 4-year-old boy in Pakistan who needed a heart operation, was about to die. And Barry tried everything he could to bring that boy across to America, and he failed. And you could see he was being interviewed, and he breaks down. He starts crying. So you have these horror stories and these really good people fighting to somehow restore that version of America that we all respect and love. Bernie Stone in Chicago, deputy mayor of Chicago, he told me again on camera, he said, I am more popular among the Muslims, the Pakistanis, than among my own people, the Jewish people. And I said, why? And he said, because as deputy mayor, I named this street in Chicago Jinnah Street. So you have an actual street in Chicago named after the founder of Pakistan. There's one called Gandhi Street also there next to it, and the Mujibur Rahman Street. So here's Bernie Stone now reaching out to the minorities, which is very much in the tradition of America. I also found in the field that most Americans, not all of them, but most Americans, were not really connecting the dots. They were not connecting the reasons why it is important for the United States and Canada to begin to understand the Muslim world in a way that they can build bridges with it. What President Obama, President Bush, General David Petraeus have again and again said, to win hearts and minds. And what are the reasons? Here are the reasons. Because they're talking from the basis of self-interest, the interests of the United States of America. So why should these Americans want to win hearts and minds? They want to win hearts and minds because right now there are hundreds of thousands of troops in the Muslim world. Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, maybe Somalia, maybe Yemen. These are all Muslim countries. The logic is that if you win the mainstream population, you marginalize the extremists and the men of violence, and you defeat them or completely push them into a corner and make them ineffective much, much sooner than if you're struggling with the entire society. Now, right now, you have very high levels of anti-Americanism, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's Pakistan, really high levels. So this is one reason, American troops, Canadian troops in the Muslim world. Second reason, the Muslim world population, it's 1.5 billion. 57 nations. In America, Muslims are now emerging. There are two congressmen already in the United States. And the Muslim world is not going anywhere. It is there. It will remain. So it may be in a phase, in a period of its history, in terms of the chaos and the violence we are seeing, but it will be there. It will be there in one form or the other. So it is in the interest of the West to really have some relationship and therefore help perhaps the modernist regain the ascendancy rather than take them all on and challenge them in this way. Then foreign policy. United States foreign policy rests on the notion that there are 9 pivotal, quote-unquote, pivotal states, according to the experts, on which American foreign policy rests. Of these 9, 5 are Muslim. Think of the importance of these 5 nations, that 5 out of the 9 pivotal states are Muslim. American foreign policy would collapse without these 5 pivotal states. Now, you cannot have friendship and desire to win hearts and minds in even these 5 pivotal states and burn the Quran and beat up Muslims and demonize them. You just can't. That's a contradiction. And that contradiction plays on the media and it's picked up in the Muslim world and that creates a lot of confusion. And it is so bad right now, it is so bad that many Americans today actually believe that President Obama is a Muslim. I'm not sure of the statistics in Canada. Is there a feeling here that he's a secret Muslim or a Muslim? Is there any opinion on this? Well, in the United States, something like 30% actually believe he's a Muslim. And so a lot of the attacks on him or on Islam, some commentators believe, is politically inspired. Because if you can attack Islam and show that it's a terrible religion, you're basically saying that our president is not to be trusted, so vote him out of office and get someone from another party. So that's also in the mix right now in terms of Islam. And the final point, I've already hinted at that, is the U.S. Constitution and the idea of America. That every citizen, irrespective of his religion or color or creed, is to have the privileges and rights that all citizens need to have. About Islam, there's a debate in America that somehow Islam and the United States of America are incompatible. They're on collision course. They will always be in conflict. And I was able to dig out, because I'm an anthropologist, not a historian, but in order to write this study into a book, I had to become a historian and really go back to the foundations of America and read everything about the Founding Fathers. And I was amazed at the Founding Fathers. I really was. I knew they were extraordinary figures. Here's John Adams, one of the Founding Fathers, on the Prophet. This debate is important because this defines the Founding Fathers on world religions, all religions, but specifically here on Islam. John Adams on the Prophet, he calls him one of the, quote-unquote, greatest truth seekers of history. And he's up there for Adams along with Socrates and Confucius. For Benjamin Franklin, he's a model of compassion. Thomas Jefferson hosted the first iftar, that is the opening of the fast in the month of fasting at the White House, the first president to do so, a tradition maintained by all the presidents. So President Obama recently had his iftar in Washington inviting Muslim leaders, and I was privileged to be there at the White House. And President Bush had his iftar every year, and again I was privileged to be there. So that tradition began with Jefferson. It was discontinued, then picked up, I think President Clinton picked it up again. And Washington, of course, reached out specifically to Jews, wrote to this famous letter to the rabbis, and Muslims. So he's stretching out his hand in friendship to Muslims. So it's not difficult to see that while the debate in America is ferociously, ferociously angry and controversial and heated about Islam, that in fact it is about American identity. What is being debated is not so much Islam alone, but American identity. What is the kind of America that Americans want for themselves? What will be the shape and form and content of this great nation in the 21st century? And it is, in every sense, a great nation. It is a world leader. It's the superpower right now. It is in terms of content, in terms of power, in terms of imagination and history. But even superpowers have challenges, and it is facing challenges. So let me conclude by pointing to the way ahead. What should we be doing? All of us, scholars, professors, writers, commentators. First of all, I believe after these two projects, two studies, which have spanned almost a decade, that we need to be looking at relations with the Muslim world in a holistic frame. We cannot look at them in a simplistic frame. It has to be holistic. We need to be aware that if we do this, this is going to happen. If we do this, this is going to happen. And if we are to implement something, we need to implement it perhaps indirectly through some other way. So holistic. Secondly, long term. These problems in the Muslim world have no short-term solutions. They have long-term. They require long-term handling, long-term solutions. And thirdly, the interconnectedness of our world. So if the pastor is going to burn the Quran in Florida, General David Petraeus in Afghanistan is appealing to him to not do so. Has this ever happened in history where a commander in the middle of a battle is appealing to his fellow nations, national, across several continents to not do something? It's happening because the world we live in is interconnected. Whatever is happening here is having an impact over there, and vice versa. The chaos and the anarchy there is being reflected here in America. So if something's happening in Pakistan, mosques are being blown up, or Sufi shrines are being blown up, or Christians are being harassed, America is listening and watching it with great alarm and saying, what sort of a country is this? Is this Islam? Is this the Islam you're talking about? So here we have challenges on both sides. We need a procedure, a process of dialogue. But by dialogue, I don't mean just us talking and going home. Dialogue that is based in some determination to genuinely begin a process of interaction and exchange, repeated, frequent in homes, in houses of worship. More important, we need understanding. Not just that we are going to talk and everything will be fine. That won't work. And it has not worked. You're seeing it with the Palestinians and the Israelis, where even the dialogue hasn't, this first step hasn't been taken. We need understanding of the problems. Sophisticated, complex. Pakistan. America has been very generous with Pakistan, as has Canada. Billions of dollars have been pumped in. Since 9/11, I'm not sure of the exact figure, a lot of it is overt, but it may be $20-25 billion. President Obama is committed to give $1.5 billion for the next 5 years. That's a lot of money for a country like Pakistan. The question we have is, where has this money gone? Has it changed the lives of ordinary Pakistanis? Are they better off? Are they thankful to Americans? Are they saying, thank you, our wonderful friends, you've saved us? Or we have to ask ourselves, why are they still so angry? Why is there so much anti-Americanism in spite of this generosity? What is going on? So understanding what can happen then, what can we do, what is the strategy? What I believe, and this is my personal opinion, I was educated at a college called Foreman Christian College in Lahore. And that college is even today one of the most popular colleges in Pakistan and not attacked by the Taliban, to the best of my knowledge. And yet it's a college run by American Presbyterians. So this college in my time produced two presidents, President Musharraf and President Lagari. This is a college that has produced an entire generation, two generations of civil servants and politicians and scholars. Now, if the Americans were to say, we are going to give you these billions of dollars, we are giving them this committed, you're our key ally, we respect you, we love you, we trust you, and tongue in cheek there. But we are going to give this. You now ensure, you guarantee that 50% of this is going to be used, 50% for education. It will change Pakistan's society and Afghanistan if that is the amount going into education. Simply create schools and colleges and the conditions where these kids can get a decent education. Every Afghan Pakistani father and family will bless Americans. Can be done very easily. It's not being done. We have billions of dollars going into God knows where. We know a lot of it goes into the army and defense services. We know many Pakistanis complained, particularly in Balochistan. A resolution was passed in the assembly that the army was used to kill one of their leading sardars, one of the senior, most respected figures, Sardar Bukhti, a Baloch chief. He was killed by precisely these weapons coming from the United States. So the aid that is meant to make friends and win hearts and minds is not winning hearts and minds. And yet it can easily happen if we emphasize things that we all respect, certainly on a campus like this, education. Teachers' training programs, syllabi, look at the curriculum, get in teachers, send your best scholars from here to the to countries in the Muslim world, bring their scholars here, educate them, and overnight, this ocean liner will begin to shift direction. Even today, the madrasas, and I asked President Musharraf this when he was president, and it's in my first book, about the madrasas. And he said, I'm under a lot of pressure. Vice President Dick Cheney rings me up, the president rings me up and said, do something about the madrasas. Close them. And I say, if I close them, you'll have millions of kids loose, ready to join the jihad. Jihad, I mean, they're being taught a very narrow version of Islam. They're not being taught Rumi and Hafiz. They're being taught a very narrow version of Islam. And they're like a gun ready to go off. So they'll go off to Kashmir or they'll go off to Afghanistan or they'll go and fight for a cause some way or the other. But if you took the same kids, you took the same madrasas and simply reformed them, brought in the best teachers, opened their minds up, bring in computers, teach them sports, begin to involve them in the modern world in the 21st century, you will change that entire region. It's not happening so far, I can assure you. So it is a cause of concern. Finally, and this is something I think that all of us, citizens of the United States and Canadians, can take great pride from, and that is a statue. Some of you may have seen it outside the University of Virginia. The University of Virginia was created by Thomas Jefferson, and that was one of his great sources of pride. There's a statue at the entrance. People had erected it in his honor with an angel holding a tablet. And the tablet says, Religious Freedom, 1786. And the first name is God, then Jehovah, then Allah, then Brahma, Atma. And looking at it, I was taken aback. I knew the Abrahamic faiths, even Islam. I mean, Allah in 1786, how many Muslims, how many Americans were conscious of Allah in 1786? And yet it's there. But to include a non-Abrahamic faith like Hinduism is the ultimate acknowledgement of the universality of our human species. That all the faiths are going to be part of this great new nation. That vision exists. And in some senses, I believe the debate really is about that. Can America prove to be America, to live up to its own ideals? It is a severe challenge at every level, and I can only hope and pray that they succeed in rediscovering those great ideals that created the nation. It, as I said, it's a challenge. The next couple of years are going to continue to see this test and this challenge. It will not be easy, but we have these examples. They're out there. they're tangible, and they're visible, and therefore they continue to inspire. So with that, thank you very much, and I should be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure there are questions from our audience.
Professor Ahmad, with all due respect, I would go a little further than you. I would suggest that as important as the Islamic problem is, and it certainly is, there's a much more serious problem in the world, namely, on a global basis, both within and without the Muslim societies, we have the collapse of the middle through sins of omission as well as commission. There are no other explanations to explain the genocides of the 20th century, the continued hunger, disease, etc. Just in the United States, we've had the controversy recently about the health plan, where the Americans couldn't get together sufficiently to have a plan to protect those that are unprotected, for example. So it seems to me that it's aside of the specifics involved in each case, there's an existential problem here in terms of humanity itself, that people are lost. They don't seem to see, I mean, aside, obviously there are many distinguished individuals doing wonderful things. But as humanity as a whole, I don't think there are sufficient numbers of people who are prepared to take a stand on important issues involving their neighbors, etc. Now, obviously it's a complicated question, there's no easy answer. But what would your thinking be in terms of a wider perspective instead of just the question of Islam?
Professor, if you see the book, Journey into America, and go to the last few pages, that is exactly what I have done. I have moved out of that particular case study to the global stage. Because like you, I do believe there's an existentialist crisis. As an anthropologist, I was focused on the community that I was studying, but then I drew to the broader conclusions. I would go beyond what you pointed out. I would say there's even a bigger crisis because we are facing the crisis of global warming. We are facing the crisis of mass poverty, mass hunger, HIV, the pandemic in Africa, and so on. And we are seeming to be totally indifferent to these crises. We seem to just not be even aware of them, let alone tackling them. I believe that once again, we need to rediscover, for me, the compassion that is in every faith, the great examples we have. You have, for example, I would like to give this example with the permission of the Pakistan ambassador. I don't want him to be sensitive about it. But of Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, the man who, during the worst rioting between Hindus and Muslims in India in 1947, packed up, he didn't take part in the celebrations that were going on and people were assuming important roles. And he went in a shanty town and began a fast unto death to prevent the killing of between Hindus and Muslims. A man who could start the day by reading from the Quran, from the Bible, and from the other holy texts. So someone who transcends, like a Mandela, like a Mother Teresa, those are the leaders who may point the way forward. Now that is, of course, wishful thinking, but we don't have leaders like that. The circumstances may throw them up. Our job, certainly mine as a professor, is to simply point the direction in terms of the people who existed, who are like that, who are able to show us the way, so that perhaps in the younger generation, people become conscious of them. Because if we don't have these examples, you have a young generation growing of age in this environment, and it's not a happy environment today. It's an environment fraught with anxiety, uncertainty, tension, and therefore people are very focused on their own immediate problems and are not able to look at this big picture. Because I really think in some senses, the human species has sort of arrived at a critical turning point. If we continue the way we are continuing, I don't know how long we are going to exist. Not simply in terms of the planet blowing up or some meteor hitting us, but simply in terms of ratio between population, resources, and our capacity to kill each other in much more sophisticated technological ways which will improve over the next couple of decades.
Just one added comment, and I'll be very brief. Unfortunately, your choice of Jefferson is a little problematic, because despite his great contribution to human thought and freedom, he remained a slave owner his life.
We know that, Professor. If you were living then, you'd probably have some slaves, because that was the context we're talking in. So I don't think there's much of a point, certainly from an intellectual in the 21st century, you're commenting on a figure in the 17th. You have to see him and everyone, how they actually were able to translate an idea of a nation. So even the Declaration which has his immortal words about all men are born equal, allows Lincoln in the next century and JFK in the next century after that to then fill in the colors. Fill in the fact that today in the United States you have an immigrant from India as a governor, two governors in fact, and very soon you will have immigrants and non-white people playing their roles precisely because of the words in the Constitution, which go back to Jefferson. We know all the problems. The book has all the details about Sally Hemings and so on. And we know that in that context, perhaps you and I would have behaved exactly like you'd have probably been the master, I'd have probably been the slave, but we'd still have...
Anyway, thank you.
Hi, thanks so much for your talk. As a scholar of U.S. religion, two things you said struck me, and I just wanted a clarification. So the first was that you mentioned that there are mosques that are actually run by and presumably have more than 50% membership who are white converts. I was curious if you could tell us mm-hmm. just a little more about that. And the other thing is that you mentioned that 40% of African Americans, well, at the time, Africans who would have come over as slaves were Muslim. As far as I know, the research on that is very sketchy, and nobody really knows, hasn't been able to put their finger on what the percentage is. So I was curious where you were getting that number.
Again, great questions. Interested me a great deal. The white converts are in themselves very interesting. The question I had for myself as an anthropologist was, why should a white American give up living in perhaps the most free society in the world, especially women, give up their freedom to create these boundaries around themselves? So I began to delve into this and discovered that 4 out of 5 converts among the white converts are women, which startled me. I thought it would be the other way around. So there are mosques, there are centers where the white converts dominate. They're doing very well. They've always had a niche in Islam, as you know. Yusuf Islam being one of the very famous converts. In America, Hamza Yusuf has a star status in the United States. Yeah. And they are prominent, and they have their own niche, as it were, within Islam. As far as the figure
for... Sorry, if it's 4 out of 5 are women, though... They actually, then at an institutional level, are they actually running these mosques? Or
they're not. Some of the women I know that we interviewed were running their own Muslim women's groups and things, mm-hmm. not running independent mosques. They are dominant in some. I think Hamza Yusuf has his own mosque. He's, in fact, just launched a university or at least a college to train imams.
Yeah.
So they are there and they are prominent. It's the numbers. They're not as many as the immigrants who would have by sheer numbers their own mosques. Now, the African Americans, this figure is an interesting question because I was curious. It got really, really interesting and amusing as we talked to some of the enthusiastic young African American imams who went on to support their thesis that Islam first discovered America by giving explanations of the names in America. Mm-hmm. For example, Tallahassee. And this young imam on camera explains it as deriving from the Islamic Tel Allah Hasi. So, you know, this becomes Tallahassee. Or California from Khalifa Fornia, from Khalif. Or America, Amir, which means the leader. So, Amir Akka. Now, these are, of course, I think, semantics that anyone can be involved in this kind of exercise and create this kind of argument. But the figures that we got, higher figures, were from Haji Talib, who did some study. He's a prominent imam in New York, and you can go to his website and check out where he got his sources from. They apparently have gone back to the ships and they have tried to trace where these people are coming from. So if they're coming from a certain part of West Africa on the coast, where there are Muslim tribes, then it's logical to assume that they would be Muslim. So I agree with you, these are vague numbers. But the point I want to convey is that a large proportion, even if it's not 30, 40, even if it's 20%, is a huge proportion of these who are Muslim. And if you see the pattern that the slaves are being picked up from West Africa, that is where Muslims are dominant. So it would be logical to assume that they would be Muslim.
Or moreover, I think your main point would be that there's a created usable path there for African Americans, regardless,
yes,
whether it's 1% or 40%.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to know how Muslims are thinking about President Obama, and does that change from America to different Muslim countries? And did it change from his campaign now to this point in time?
Again, a very interesting question. I think Muslims were very excited when he first announced his candidacy. I was in Buffalo in a school, and I asked these kids, the young 8-10-year-old, I spent the whole day in class with them, and I asked them, I said, who are you going to vote for? It was then between Obama and McCain. And everyone said Obama, except one girl. She said McCain. She may have been a bit confused, but they all said Obama. And the reason they said Obama was very interesting. I said, why Obama? And they, of course, he's a Muslim. They're so convinced that he's a Muslim. To a Muslim, the fact that his name is Hussein, Barack Hussein, these are two names which are Muslim, that his father is a Muslim, that he grows up in Indonesia, assumes certain sympathy or empathy for Muslims. Now, once he comes in as president, he is somewhat distant from associating with Muslims because the media can be ruthless. It can be devastating. An image of Obama in a mosque would have headlines saying he's back home in his own house of worship. So the result is that while President Bush went several times to a mosque, give him credit for that, and said repeatedly that Islam is a religion of peace, the war is not with Islam, for whatever else he did, Obama still has not gone to a mosque in the United States. So Muslims are, I would say, becoming very disenchanted. And more than this, more seriously than this, they were hoping that their status, the human rights violations and the sort of civil liberties being compromised in many cases in the United States, Guantanamo Bay itself, the whole issue of torture, this would be resolved by Obama, which he had promised to do. And that has not happened either.
Thank you.
And the Muslim world is the same thing. The Muslim world is looking at him, and they had very many great expectations and high hopes, and they have not been realized.
Thank you.
Are there further questions? I have a question. I was really interested in the classification that you offered at the beginning, namely the mystics, the modernists, and the literalists. And I wondered whether that classification suggested that perhaps this may not be at heart an existential crisis, is a term that's been mentioned both here and elsewhere, or a political crisis, but perhaps a crisis of scriptural hermeneutics, and not only one that afflicts the Islamic world, but one that perhaps afflicts us just as much, that these categories might be applicable, if we think about them, to ourselves, that post-Enlightenment Western secular culture is perhaps in a kind of hermeneutical crisis itself. And there might be something, I suppose in a way I'm kind of inviting you to just comment on that observation and whether you think there's a way in which perhaps Pogo is right, that I have seen the enemy and he is us, that we perhaps need to contemplate his wisdom.
I think that's a great last question. We'll discuss it over dinner. We'll carry on because it's such an important question. You're right, this is not the existentialist crisis, but this is internal to Islam. And it is not a new crisis. This is a crisis that goes straight back to the scripture. It's the interpretation of scripture because each one of these categories, and here is the paradox of Islam or the contradiction within Islam, each one of these categories goes back to the Quran and the Prophet. So each one refers to the authority of the Prophet, the Sufi, the modernist, and the literalist. So in that sense, yes, and of course, Karen Armstrong in her The Battle for God and so many other books has very, in a very scholarly way, in a very thorough way, pointed out that exactly this crisis between what she calls the fundamentalists and the modernists exists in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and done a sort of the parallels between the fundamentalists of each faith, creating the tension and the conflict. So in that sense, this is not new. I took these really from my understanding of Muslim society, especially in South Asia, because the three great centers in South Asia, Deoband, Aligarh, and Ajmer, are classic in terms of defining Islam according to these three categories. Ajmer has the classic Sufi saint there, who lived 1,000 years ago. Deoband is the classic orthodox literalist center even now. And Aligarh, of course, produced the great university which produced so many generations of Muslim modernists. So this battle is still being fought and will continue to be fought and perhaps never be resolved.
Do you have time for one more?
Yes.
Okay. My question is, well, I'm an American and I live 45 minutes away from New York City, and I was privileged to be able to go to the Middle East 2 years after September 11th. So my question is, America used to be called the land of the free and the brave, but today it seems to be characterized more as the land of the ignorant and the arrogant. In a country where my peers get their best source of news from a comedy show, The Daily Show, and get their entertainment from movies such as Sex and the City, my question is, in terms of the media, I've noticed that they seem to reify Islam as either a religion of peace or a religion that is oppressive to women. And my question is, what is the role of the media in shaping and educating Americans? And I want to know if they have any responsibility. Thank you.
I think that's a great question, because you're really talking not about America and the media and informing and educating its population, but any society living today. I mean, literally all societies, including societies in the Middle East and in Muslim countries, and I, of course, on that journey, discovered this. All societies are now, because people have, especially the young, have so little time, there's so many pressures, and people are inclined then to take their news on the go, and they take the news from television, from tweets, and the iPhone and emails, and there's very little sitting down and absorbing and digesting news. Perhaps the older generation, perhaps some of them. So it becomes critical for the media to be responsible. Now the media, and having dealt with them, and again this is not an American phenomenon, this is a 21st century phenomenon. Remember, these changes have taken place in the last 2-3 decades. When I was in Balochistan, we were struggling with an electric typewriter. That was the ultimate in modern technology, because we were suddenly aware that you could do click, click, and the thing would move fast. And when I arrived in Cambridge in the 1990s, and I was told there's something called the email, and there's something, I just couldn't believe it. I said, there must be some trick to this, because you can't have press a button and my friend in Islamabad is going to pick it up. These technological changes have taken place in the last 2-3 decades. And it has had a major impact on media, on the news, and how we get our news. So it's much simpler, as you said, the comedy show, the Daily Show, informing you as to how you align yourself with, say, something Sarah Palin has said, or Bush or Obama, and you feel that you've got the substance of what you need to know in terms of the news. That's how it's been reduced to. It's not ideal, but that's the reality. Now, if that is the case, then the next question is, as you say, how is Islam being depicted? Now, for various reasons, and I pointed out Obama as being the president and representing the Democratic Party, Obama's association in the media with Islam serves a political purpose. So it is in the interest of some people who have influence in the media to continuously bombard the public with the idea that he may be a Muslim. And Islam is violent, Islam treats women badly, Islam is a religion of terrorism, and so on and so on, and Obama is a Muslim. Now, if you're getting your news from the media, you'll start believing it. And I gave you the example of the Sharia, which is such an absurd, absurd suggestion that the Sharia is about to take over the United States. And yet, because people are getting their news from the media, Americans genuinely believe that this is about to happen. And the other position in terms of Islam, the position that Islam is a religion of peace, that is largely the fault of the Muslim leadership, which has also failed to explain Islam satisfactorily, in a scholarly way, in a neutral way. So the result is that a lot of the Muslim leaders simply stand up in the media or stand up before an audience and they will chant, Islam is a religion of peace, Islam is a religion of peace. Now no one buys that because it's said in the context of 3,000 people being killed on 9/11. So you can't kill 3,000 people and then stand up and say, we are a religion of peace. There has to be some explanation, there has to be some more sophisticated understanding of this phenomenon. That's not happening. So you can understand that, therefore, Americans do not believe the Muslims when they say it's a religion of peace. And if I tell them, I give them these quotes about Jesus, they simply won't believe them. Because they'll say, on this channel, we heard that Islam is a religion of idol worshippers. Or they believe in the moon god. So how can you respect Jesus? They just won't believe it because their prophet has become the television set, not the book, not the printed word. So in that sense, that is the existentialist challenge the professor was talking about to us as a civilization. Where can we produce and draw on those figures of compassion and humanity? That will be the challenge of the 21st century. And some of the thinkers of the 20th century were already talking about this. Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, George Orwell, 1984. They were already seeing this world. So this is one of the dangers we do face, the drifting into the situation.
Thank you, Professor, for your presentation. I'm glad you spoke about what people do and don't believe about Islam, because in your presentation, I sense there is a need in this conflict to draw on some idealized versions, whether it's an idealized version mm-hmm. of what it is to be Muslim or to be American. Constantly refer to the American ideal and the idea of America. In a conflict, and I think it's one way to see this, it is a situation mm-hmm. of conflict. And I draw on a South African experience mm-hmm. where the way to deal with the conflict was to idealize mm-hmm. at some level what it meant to be on the various sides of the fence. The result of that has been, so many years later, the idealized notions, these concepts, have lost their utility. And I sort of want you to share with us a bit as to what do you think the utility is of these notions, of an idea of America that Muslims are now trying to adapt themselves to as they try to become American Muslims.
It's not only the Muslims, I think, as I said, I see a lot of Americans fighting for that ideal because they're conscious. You see, like the young student has said that Americans are seen in a certain way abroad. And she's right. That's how they're seen. And it hurts Americans. It challenges Americans because Americans essentially are not like that. So it is a challenge to what they know as their ideal. And without an ideal, no nation can survive, no family can survive because it's a standard that we aspire to. As a child, you look up to someone and you feel that your mother or your father or your grandfather, someone you're constantly wanting to measure up, or your teacher, that's a goal that you set for yourself in life. In South Africa, you're very lucky you had someone like Mandela who set up that standard and set up such a high standard that future generations of leaders can say, we want to aspire to that standard. Without that, you really have a Hobbes of society fighting all against all. Because then everyone is in itself, in himself or herself, a standard and an ideal. And that could become as close to anarchy as you can get, like you have in the Muslim world, where everything is being attacked, everything is being rejected. So there has to be a center, and that center must hold. I don't mean in a militaristic sense, I mean in an idealistic sense.
I'm trying to get to the difficulties that Muslims are encountering as they try to make themselves.
Muslims have no problem. They were, as I told you, before 9/11, they had the most comfortable situation in the world, as they will tell you, in America. Go back to the history, it's in my chapter. Muslims coming to America did not go through what the Italians and the Jews went through, which was a century of struggle. They came through primarily because of JFK and Johnson's Nationality Act in the mid-60s. So they flew in literally into positions as doctors and engineers and physicians, and they lived very comfortable lives. There was no clash. And they appreciated this ideal America because they embodied it. They lived the American dream. The challenge today for them is to be able to hold on to that dream, to remind Americans that that is what America is, and under that dream, they can live as respected citizens. Americans are aware that that dream may be in danger because of all these debates about torture and surveillance and civil rights violation. There is a big debate taking place in America that American society itself may be now changing so rapidly that may be very difficult then to pull back. This young generation, remember 10 years ago, this young student would have been, what, 10 years old or something? So she's really grown up, this whole generation, in the shadow of 9/11, where the argument is that whatever it takes to keep us secure, we should do. Simple as that. So someone like Dick Cheney, who actually argued for torture on that basis, waterboarding, that was apparently his favorite. And the argument was that this will save us from future strikes, future terror threats, future terror manifestations in the United States. Now that is again a debate about America and the ideal. And the only thing halting them or stopping them is in fact the ideal. The fact that Washington and Jefferson did speak on torture. Then you go back to the ideal. Who do you refer to? You go back to the Constitution or the Founding Fathers, which in some senses for Americans, although they are in that sense secular, for them that is the mythology of beginning, the mythology of Genesis, the creation. So if you have a debate on torture, refer to Washington and Jefferson.
I don't mean to continue a discussion, but just to finish my question, I don't see Muslims working to an American ideal. I think Muslims work to an ideal of what it is to be Muslim. And I think my question is, how do you think, and it can, you know, we can talk
no,
later.
No, I don't see, first of all, I don't know how you're saying that.
As to how Muslims will be able to or are required to bring these two ideals together.
No, first of all, I don't understand when you say they're working to their own. Two congressmen, the only two congressmen are African-American Muslims. So how are they not working towards American and Muslim ideals? There's no conflict in them.
Okay. We can talk.
And I've talked to both of them, and they represent both America and Islam successfully.
I think we have one final question here. Thank you. My name is Thomas. I'm a PhD student here. My question is a bit of a follow-up on Professor Kirby's question about your taxonomy.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering about perhaps this is a reflection of a Deoband bias in my formation in Islamic studies, but my sense is that there's a sense in which, compared to other religions, literalism is a bit of an intrinsic dynamic of the faith in terms of beliefs around the Quran and its providence mm-hmm. directly from God. Does this pose a problem for your for your model in your view? If we take a census among Muslims, if we ask them, do you believe that literally in the Quran? My sense is that most Muslims will say yes, regardless of whether they're mystics, and mystics might believe that it's literally true and also allegorically true, or the modernists would still believe it's true. Perhaps they'd be more like. Like people who believe the Constitution is literally true, but believe that we have to take the modern times into context as well. So perhaps it's
I had explained that the three categories are each one going back to the sources of Islam. So none of them are saying we're outside the sources. And therefore, each one of them goes back to the Quran and the Prophet. And the two are inseparable. And you're right, if the literalist says we want to be exactly like what the Quran requires, the modernist may say, I would like to be, but I can't be because I'm living in the modern world. But he's not going to say, I dismiss the Quran. No Muslim will say that. Mm-hmm. Or the Sufi. The Sufi must become a Sufi only after having passed through the stages of orthodoxy. So if you read Rumi, Rumi's poems are love poems, and the love is for the Prophet. It's a love poem, whether for Jesus or the Prophet. These are love poems within the context of the Quran, within the context of faith itself. So therefore, all three are looking at the same object, but in different positions. And that is the debate, and that is, I think, the eternal dilemma of all philosophers, looking at the same object from different perspectives. It isn't a question of either or, and this is a mistake that I think a lot of modernists make, and a lot of people looking outside at Islam, that somehow the literalists will say we have the Quran, and the modernists, the Sufis will say, you know, it's like a hippie kind of trance that everything is one and everything is the same. It's not that. These are very devout people. The Sufis, above all, a very devout individual whose path is the path of Sufism. He may have given up the world, but he gave it up for a purpose. Similarly with the modernist, he's not giving up his faith. He is changing the shape of the faith to adjust to modernity, but he's not saying, I give it up. And that is something I think easily overlooked even by Muslims, because Muslims somehow associate the Deoband or the literalist with Islam, and then they say, we are, as it were, opposed. And some are, like Ataturk, for example. Ataturk in Turkey, as you know, was the classic example of the opposite of the literalist, where he said anyone with a beard is not even allowed to be employed by the government. Any woman with a hijab does not have access to campus. Even today, a woman wearing a hijab can't come on a campus. So McGill is probably more advanced than Turkey in terms of treating women. And yet, here you are, the three in play, the three, each one devout in its own way, battling for Islam. And this complexity is not really known outside the world of Islam. That was my point. That we need to see each one as an authentic version in play, battling for what it understands as Islam.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Thomas.
First of all, thank you very much, Professor Ahmed, for an extremely stimulating and illuminating lecture. We're very grateful indeed. Please give some applause. But before ending, I would like to remind people that there's a reception downstairs, as usual. And also I would like to thank His Excellency Mian Zeb, who is present with us tonight, the High Commissioner of Pakistan to Ottawa. So thank you for coming, sir. Yeah. His Excellency is the brother-in-law of our lecturer. So we're delighted to have you here.
A bit of nepotism here.
do join us downstairs for a further chat.
Thank you. Thank you, President.
Thank you very much.